welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my very special guest, Sam Housen. Sam, I'm a little bit excited for today. I've had a few conversations with people about the effect of music in the New Apostolic Reformation, how it just totally rearranges the way that the Christian mission goes forward. And people really seem to connect with that because people, I think, are getting, like me, they're getting bruised by the music. And quite frankly, after you get out of it, you're triggered by the music, which is a conversation that we'll have. But also, I don't know if you know this or not, but I've also been digging into the climax, the epicenter which was happening between Chuck Smith, John Wimber, the shepherding movement, basically the explosion that laid the bedrock for what would become New Apostolic Reformation. And I'm on the fence as to whether it was a good thing or a bad thing, but I have been strongly examining the way John Wimber changed the worship style. And here's why I really wanted to have this conversation with you. In the United States, this has been largely dubbed a good thing. They see this as a positive change. But in the UK, I'm getting people who are telling me that this was the worst thing that ever happened to Christianity in the UK. So I have had some conversations on the United States side, and many of them are positive. A few of them I've shared on the podcast. Now I wanted to see from your perspective, what happened to music in the UK? And with that, I'll let you reintroduce yourself for anybody who does not know who you are.
Thanks, John. Yeah, I feel fairly well placed to talk about this, not because of any kind of authority I have now, but because of the experience I've had over the last probably 30 years, really, and in positions of having a bit of responsibility around music too. So when I first started going to church as a child with my parents, we were part of a Baptist church. You know, one of the sort of, and you have it in the US as well, those big Baptist churches in the middle of a town. It's one of the churches, you know, they're often, they have a similar look and feel. And in the US, maybe they have a different look, but in Britain, they're often big brick built buildings, you know, a large space for a congregation. And then obviously the baptistry at the front. Now, in that kind of context, in the 80s and early 90s that I used to attend church with my parents, you know, and my dad is a pianist, and he would often play. That music wasn't entirely exciting. they were hymns, often Wesley, obviously, and that kind of thing. My dad would play lovely piano, I'm sure, I don't really remember, but he would play off to the left, you know, where the piano was. And the congregation was probably 150, 200 people, you know. It was a singing hymns kind of church. I remember then at school, I was part of a Church of England church, which is an Anglican church or Episcopal for you guys. And it was much, much the same. The organ would be playing, we'd be in the congregation, and I remember yawning rather than singing because it was just so dull in this dusty church. And then all of a sudden, for us anyway, Soul Survivor, which I spoke about with you before, sort of introduced a new way of bringing the sort of pop music that was more in the kind of charismatic Pentecostal churches at the time into those more dusty churches that I grew up in. So Soul Survivor, what they did incredibly well was bring the kind of emotion of music into the tradition and the dusty historic church. And so for me, that was like a wow, this is exciting. I started playing guitar at 11, and we were talking just moments ago, you know, I was learning Metallica songs at 11. I was learning like all those intricate bits by Kirk Hammett. I'd learn them, Guns N' Roses. So for me, the guitar was something I could really communicate and express myself with. It became the thing that, I mean, I used to play for hours every night, like so many of us in my bedroom, learning all the different lines. And then I got to a stage where I'd start trying to write my own songs. Wasn't so good at lyrics at first, but the guitar was the kind of vehicle for me just to express myself, perhaps where I struggled verbally or certainly academically. so it became the vehicle. And then with Soul Survivors and my kind of proximity to it, where, you know, I'm 46, depressingly, now. And I remember that kind of placed me at 16 in 96, and earlier as a teenager. So around this kind of time I was learning the guitar, Soul Survivor were kind of brought this different way of how church not only can express itself with music, but it was safe. You know, like the Pentecostal, the charismatic churches, it, when coming from those churches, we kind of were frowned on. My parents were involved in like a house church movement in the early 80s, which had a lot of fallout. So I think they returned to their history, which was the safe, dusty place. But what Soul Survivor did was make it, brought these two worlds together. I had a place where I hadn't mastered, but I'd become quite good on the guitar. I learned to sing, and it became this place where, wow, I can bring what I experience with music in with the kingdom of heaven and the stuff that we talk about and the Bible that I'd learned as a child together. So saying, was it the worst thing? I think it's more complex than that, because if for me as a teenager, there was a culture that felt like it was mine.
You know, I'm glad that you responded in that way, because it is complicated. I grew up from coast to coast. We lived everywhere from Arizona to South Carolina, everywhere between. Most of that was going into cult churches. Some of them, most of them small, some of them a little bit larger, but nothing like the churches you're describing, these big Baptist churches, right? Yeah. And I grew up in a lot of rural towns or mid-sized towns where you really didn't have enough people to support that kind of building. And so mm-hmm. even the Baptist church in the small town is just a little Baptist church, you know. So I grew up in that mentality. But whenever I moved into the larger cities, they did have some of the larger churches. Some of them were so large. There's one here they call Six Flags Over Jesus. It's so massive. And I got to thinking about it recently. You know, if you're in a small community, and some rural community builds this massive, massive church complex, which I've actually seen that happen, it's kind of odd, because what's the purpose of this? You're sucking people out of their small communities to come to your small community, and then it's no longer about the community, it's about the church. So if you're in small communities, a small church makes sense. Everybody locally gets to know each other, help each other, worship with one another. That makes sense to me. But sucking people out of their communities to come to your church doesn't make sense at all to me. That said, what do you do when you're in a big city? You've got to have a place that's large enough to hold the people, right? So if you're in a big city, a big church might make sense. But I've attended those, and when you do attend them, number one, the music is really flashy, entertaining. It's like paying to go to a concert, but you're paying tithe instead of, you know, paying the ticket admission. Number two, you don't really have a good connection with the people. There's too many people. Number three, the music is not the same. And I speak as a musician when I say this. When I was going to the smaller churches, either mainstream or cult, whenever I was playing literally to worship God. It wasn't playing for me. It wasn't playing to entertain. It wasn't playing for any other reason but just to show my worship and respect to God. And I could walk forward to any church. I could tell them, hey, I want to play the guitar. I'm going to sing a special. And we called them specials back then in the Pentecostal world.
Well, so, what does that mean? What does that mean?
It means basically I'm going to sing a solo. That's how you would say it. But you would say, I'm going to sing a special today. And I guess the language in the Pentecostal world is it's a special song. Outside of the worship songs, here's your special songs, which is weird, I know, but that's how I grew up. But the point I'm making, though, is it wasn't really to impress people. It was about showing my dedication to God, my faith, etc. And anybody could do it, no matter how bad I was. I remember playing one time, I'm going to embarrass myself. I was playing in one church service. They asked me to play, actually. And I had traveled a long ways because, long story I won't get into, but I had traveled there. They asked me to sing, and I said, sure. Well, I go up. Well, my right hand is in a cast and I can only use my index finger. So I played the piano with a left hand and an index finger, which sounded funny, but I did it. And looking back, if I had tried to do this in one of these large mega churches, they would have just laughed in my face. No, you can't do this, John. We must be more entertaining than this. And so it's more about the entertaining, really, than it is about the musician bringing worship to God, offering something to God, that they offering their gift to God, basically. It's more about the entertainment. And when I look at what happened with John Wimber in the UK, there's a quote out there. I can't remember where it comes from. It might even be from Vineyard Church website, but it says something to the effect, once Wimber came to England, he started coming year after year and conference after conference and gave the confidence to change the worship style. But is that a good thing? I started thinking through that when I read that quote, and I'm thinking, yes, it did change. Yes, it's far more entertaining, but speaking as a musician who was offering my gift as worship to God, no longer is it about me and my gift to God. It's about literally making the crowd pleased with what they hear so that they can build bigger crowds.
So I've got one question. First one is, when you played with your one finger, which I love, do you remember the impact that it had in the congregation, in that space, and in your own spirit?
I do. So as a musician, there are these, and this will feed part of our later conversation. As a musician, there are techniques that you can use that can manipulate the emotions. Back then, I would not have said that I was manipulating emotions. I didn't know what this was. I just knew that there were things I could do to make the crowd go whatever way that I wanted them to go. And I've got one finger to do it with. So what did I do? I thought very quickly through my repertoire, which wasn't that big. But there was one song that had tremendous minor tones. And so what I did with my left hand, I started playing these really, really bass minor chords. And then with my index finger, I couldn't do much, but I could kind of walk the minor chords over here. So I'd boom, 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 you know, with my hands. And it was received. One of the people said, that was the best song that I've heard you play in this church. And I did it with one finger.
Yeah, but so I'm torn at the moment. What I don't want to do is throw the whole thing out and say, I learned to manipulate people. The other side of it is, how did I experience maybe the Holy Spirit, or how was my worship of pure heart? And there was, so as I led worship as well. So, I'm still caught also on the idea of a special. But the thing which I'm not wanting to do is throw it all out. But then equally, I've had spiritual experiences at regular gigs, you know, in concerts. So this is more complex even than having that conversation around the special that you've driven miles to do. I'm a little bit caught out. So the other side of it is, more recently, I visited my local town, which is just south of London, and the church is a large church plant from perhaps one of the most influential churches in London, as in Anglican churches. It's called Holy Trinity Brompton. And they've looked to plant churches in large buildings with quick shrinking congregations. That's been their aim. And I went there one evening on my own. My wife, I think, was going to a Catholic church at the time, which she does, and I'm not so sort of into. But the guy at the front was singing, and you'll know this, and I know this from singing as well. It's as if he was, the songs he was singing, maybe he could hit a decent note where his voice just cracked. And so each song that he was singing, and this guy is probably like our age, right? So it's not like he was like early 20s, he was just enjoying showboating. He was kind of our age, and he was enjoying that note where his voice just broke, and so it sounded emotional. And I was like, I can't get past your voice cracking. I can't get past it. Let alone the words on the screen that I'm theologically tearing apart. You're just distracting me with that note that you're trying to hit. And like you're saying, he was, I mean, there was this kind of completely unabashed, unashamed, emotional going for it, or simply just a performance. And to me, it was like a caricature of everything I'd seen 30, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 30 years ago, that was happening, singing some of the same songs that I was singing 30 years ago, that was following in the trend of what you're talking about, that Wimber had perhaps forerun. So it's almost as if now is a caricature of what we were into. And this church is, one of these large kind of city churches. Well, for Britain, not in comparison with the US.
Yeah, absolutely. I have talked about the DNA of the movement several times, and I talk about the architecture of the movement. If you think back to the old tent revivals, the way it was structured, there was entertainment, but it came in the form of the speaking. Well, if you exclude the levitating boy, which is another funny story, it comes back to just the speaking, but there was forms of entertainment. In fact, I've read through some histories where they were talking about just entering into the tent meeting. There was a whole experience that was like a carnival. There would be hot dog stands outside, and the whole family would come. You didn't even have to be a Christian to want to come to one of these things because everybody's doing it, and you get hot dogs, right? So,
and there's not much else to do.
And there's not much else to do. It's a rural community kind of thing. So,
yeah.
I kind of understand how all that works, but you get inside, and they would, open up with a warm, friendly, open. It was almost down to a pattern, and they learned the pattern well. They would get people to lower their guards by talking about very open, heartwarming things that they could connect to or relate to. Start into the ministry, build up to the climax, speak really rapidly, really loudly at the climax, and then shift back to the soft organ music, and then you had the healing. So it was a healing revival. So that was really the structure. And you can almost match that pattern sermon per sermon, no matter which evangelist you go to, right? So fast forward, New Apostolic Reformation. John Wimber, if you follow the chain of people that he's going through, Chuck Smith was involved in those revivals. Chuck Smith connected to him. He is learning the techniques, but he's taking a modern twist on it. And what he's doing, if you really dissect the musical structure of what he's doing, he has trained the listeners of his music to understand that music was not just a space for worship. This was a space for an encounter, a healing, waiting on the Spirit, a response to the Spirit. So where the tent revivals would build you up to this great altar call, and then following the altar call was the healing, well, Wimber kind of changed it so that the music engaged people and made them want to do this. And so when I was playing, I would never say, even today, I would never say I was manipulating people by playing my minor chords. I was just making do with what I could do, make something a little bit better than it would sound with one finger if I played, I don't know, I'll Fly Away, something really fast, right? So I was still engaged in a worship to God mode. I wasn't engaged in a let's toy with the emotions and make people want to come to an altar call, and then get them into a suggestive state where I can call it the Holy Spirit if I want. Maybe it is the Holy Spirit, but they're literally open more to suggestion through my music. I would have just got up and walked out if they asked me to do this.
But that is happening now, right? So
Yeah.
do you know about the worship curve, all that stuff?
Yeah.
So, and that's been going on again since the 90s. There are various, I know this from a mutual. Do you know Delirious? Did you know of that band, Martin Smith?
It's kind of funny. I came out of this cult in 2012. I think they were prior to that. I think it
Yeah,
was
they
one of
were.
the groups I was not allowed to listen to, but I
Oh,
know of
really? Not
them.
allowed?
Not
Okay.
allowed. We could only, so in the Branham cult, number one, you weren't allowed any music outside of gospel, but it was a specific flavor of gospel. It had to be like Southern gospel, the old style hymns, none of the new modern worship music.
Right, wow. Okay, so Delirious essentially were the Christian version of U2, and that's what they wanted to be. Like the guitarist using Ebow, that kind of stuff. And they were formed on the south coast of Britain in a tiny little town, very much, the grey kind of place in the winter for the 2 days of summer in the days of sun in the summer. That's the beach, exciting. So they were kind of formed there, and they became quite a big deal in the Christian music scene. And they became and Martin Smith wrote a number of worship songs that were used across the church in the US as well. He's known very well. Now he continues to tour each month the US. Every month he's over your side of the pond, and he's training worship leaders how to do this stuff. And he makes good money on it. He's able to, you know, pay his large mortgage, or I don't know, school fees or grandchildren fees, I think, as well. That's the culture actually requires to be taught. It's a complete antithesis of playing with one finger. Yeah. there's now this kind of this deliberate schooling, which is paid for people to learn this system, the worship curve of starting big. So what I would love to talk about is then this sort of and because I think a lot of the people I speak to don't really understand this kind of new apostolic thing and how prophecy fits in there. But the whole church meeting service, whatever we want to call it, is designed around an experience that has elation, or well, you know, this kind of nice up, hello, how are you doing in on arrival, you know, and you're welcomed at the door. So there's always welcomers, right? You may be handed a leaflet or whatever as you go in that you can have a little peruse through. You then find your seat and say hello to the people that you didn't say hello since last week, or maybe the home group that you went to. And then you start with this big song, and the guy hits that note where his voice breaks perfectly. And you all know this song, and you all sing it together. And even the people that don't attend very often know that song. And then the music will then move into this from major key, right? Quite high tempo, to minor key. And that whole process of engaging the congregation or audience into this emotional readiness to then hear quite a... And actually, the language often is about me. It's about my relationship with Jesus. It's about Jesus being quite familiar. It's being a friend. The kind of the language that we read in the Bible doesn't often translate or come through. So instead, it's this very experience-first, self-centered view of the kingdom of heaven.
I actually go back and forth on this because I like the personal relationship style worship. But all of that said, I remember I grew up on the old hymns from this big, thick red book. That's how we would sing in church. And some of it was experience based, but a lot of it was just the liturgical old, very, very old hymns. I remember reading in my research, I can't remember which one it was, Sankey, Finney, one of these guys, he's touring through the UK, and one of the outcries by all of the community was, his music is awful. It is the most, it's like one of the articles, and I wish I could find this again, but it said something to the effect, it's like an elementary student in music led our worship service. What's wrong with this man? And I got to thinking about it. Well, that's largely what I grew up on. But we did have the red hymn book. We had the red hymn book, and then we had things that came long after that were written by people who had been in the revivals. And if you compare revival music to the hymns, there's a big difference. And the difference is that the hymns are usually structured not for personal experience, but for a direct praise and worship of God. So it's like from you out to God. Yep. But the revival music was more about what's happening to you. It's about you, your experience, what you feel, the way you act. Then Wimber like put that idea, that concept on steroids. Now it's about not just what you feel, but it's more of a love type worship. You're worshiping love, essentially, and that love is part of you, your relationship to the Holy Spirit, which isn't that, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but over time, if that's all you listen to, it becomes more about you than it does worship to God. So what it does, in effect, it changes the nature of worship so that worship isn't something that's praise out to God, it's praise from God into you. Which is a little bit weird if you think about the dynamics of this.
For sure. And I think it's not just the words and the kind of, it's also the repetition So the amount of repetition, you know, that chorus that goes over and over and over. And now the guys have become slightly more sophisticated. So then you have a middle eight that you can repeat over and over and over. And there may well be some sort of link verse that you can repeat over and over and over. That isn't what is that creating? So for me now, I go into that kind of thing and I think, oh my goodness, I can't give myself up to this. I can't do that again. I can't get myself into that sort of, I don't know, is it a meditative state almost of okay, I'm going along with all these people around me singing this over and over and over, and it sort of becomes these waves, sort of nauseating waves for me. Now, what is that part of what Wimber was, I mean, some of those early songs, is it about a repetition? Is it about readying people emotionally, making them kind of, what's the, yeah, because essentially I remember those times many times, and I've led countless worship sessions doing that, knowing, okay, this is where we need to be going. I think I'm sensing the Holy Spirit that I need to be playing like this. And maybe I need to stop playing guitar because we can just hear the congregation singing, but we're still repeating over and over and over. And then maybe we need to bring the drums back in to get everyone together. And we're experimenting maybe, and certainly it felt fresh to me, but now I hear others doing it. I sort of think, what is this? Where are we, you know?
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started? Or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. I'm not that distant from my children being at such a young age that I can remember this, but when you have children, they constantly repeat themselves. They'll get a phrase stuck in their head, and they will repeat it until you wake up at 2 a.m. repeating that phrase because you heard it over and over and over all day. And then, to make matters even worse, this was amplified with YouTube. YouTube has all of these, I don't know what you call these people, but they're like, the children just migrate and flock to these guys, right? They're talking about video games and how to the perfect potato chip. There's such weird things out there. And they get into a repeating stage where they're just repeating phrases because that's appealing to the mind of a child. I still go back to that article. What is this guy thinking? It's like an elementary student is writing our music. Well, if you think of what that means, it's talking about bringing the music down to the level of the mind of a child, and the mind of a child will repeat. So, to some extent, you can say it's just because of music structure, but Wimber was a little bit above and beyond that. He was more advanced, more strategic. He was, you know, working with C. Peter Wagner in Fuller Theological Seminary. They were trying to build a strategy on church growth. In fact, it was the division of church growth that they were working with, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I know that those two men separated. I know that John Wimber, he apparently was against the new apostolic reformation, et cetera, even though he helped cause it, which is kind of interesting. However, the church growth model, I think to some extent it stuck with him. But it stuck with him different than Wagner. Wagner's view of this was a very authoritarian style. We must push forward like an army. Wimber's objective was much the same, but let's do it through music. And so when I think about that, I think about the architecture of what was happening, and he would have been doing it through music. So I'm still forming an opinion of whether he did this on purpose or not. However, if there was a strategy and there was these repetitions, Think of what you can do to the heads of people if you get them to A, shut off critical thinking, which they did, B, introduce an authoritarian structure. He's working with the shepherding guys, the most authoritarian structure that exists he's working with. I know that he separated from them, and I know that he later denounced all of this, but there's a point in time new wine is putting him on the front page. I mean, this was a collaboration to some extent. And Wimber said, we're building an army. I don't want to build a church. I want to build an army. So during that phase, whenever it was most critical, while Wagner's building a literal army of armed Christian militant style religion, Wimber's doing the same thing, but he's doing it in a worship style. So I have to think, to some extent, there had to have been a strategy. If there was a strategy, and I go back to, I watch what people did when I played these minor chords, man. They were weeping, they were crying, and I'm playing with one finger, right? So if I can have that effect on music, and I know that I can control crowds' emotions through music, what if that was my ambition, to create an army? I've never, this is nothing that I would ever do, but Wimber said he was doing it, right? If I did have that ambition, I would use my minor chords, absolutely. But there were many other things that I would do as well. The repetitions is probably the strongest one.
And I think you're right. There is a strategy. A friend of mine's a vicar in Kent, and he took over, again, another one of these big Anglican churches in the middle of the town. You know, it can seat 300, 400, whatever. When he took it over, he looked to get advice from Soul Survivor, so Mike Pilavarci. So we're talking 6 years ago, something like that. And he was told, you know, you need to hire a good worship leader. Hire. So again, in the US, it was a surprise to me when I lived in Charleston. I remember being paid to stand in, I've forgotten the name of the church, but in George Washington's box in that church where I was leading worship. And I was paid like $30 or $50 or something. I thought, wow, this is fantastic. Okay, you guys do it properly. But that's now reached the UK. You know, I'm talking 2003 when I was doing that. Now in 2026, you know, I think it's a lot more common. People are getting paid to do this worship stuff. And there is this agenda, there is this focus that the music is what's leading this stuff. The Anglican Church in Britain, the Church of England, they're putting all sorts of missional funds into the charismatic evangelical church within the Church of England, because that's what's growing. And what's the biggest distinction, perhaps, between perhaps more orthodox or more liberal Anglican churches? It's the music, you know. It's that band at the front standing underneath the cross or in front of the altar playing music in this way that we're talking about. So when you say, and when you ask the question, was it strategic and was it deliberate? Well, it's strategic and deliberate within the Church of England right now too. This doesn't stop with Wimber. But what Wimber did do was encourage this kind of familiar culture, or this familiar outside culture inside church.
Well, the other question that I would ask, and I don't know how much you would be aware of this, but so Wimber brought many different changes, some of them positive, to the church. But one of the changes he did, because he was so surrounded by music, he had this musical background.
Yeah, Righteous Brothers, right?
Righteous Brothers, right? Yeah. One of the things that's going through my head is, what was most impactful when you think of Soul Survivor? I'll ask you, as it relates to Soul Survivor, what was more impactful to Soul Survivor? Would it be the music, or would it be the philosophy surrounding the music? So Wimber had these songs, what's the one called, Spirit Song or something like this. He had songs that are doing exactly what we're talking about, but he also changed the model of the church. You had a lot of churches had like a worship leader was a pastor, the band were the facilitators of the spiritual encounter. The whole structure of the church was upended. And the problem that I see is when you look at, read through the books, the letters from Paul, for example, when it's talking about how a church should be laid out, not a single aspect of it matches what's in the Bible, not one. But Wimber did change this in many churches. Would you say his philosophy was more impactful of the church, or was the music?
I wonder if it's the focus on church planting, the sense that in order to grow, you have to focus on growth. And in order to, and that focus on growth is the point of church. And for me, where I'm still sort of struggling even now, I'm just not sure if that's right. So music becomes the vehicle. It becomes the language I've thought about before, is like the fertilized ground. It becomes the kind of, it becomes the vehicle for people to feel something. But the whole lot is still part of a show, which is essentially that sort of experience, whether it includes prophecy from the front, picking the individual, whether it's to walk to the front for prayer for something going on in the week or something that's going on in you, whether it's the talk, which has a kind of maybe a self-help nature to it or something. The music is all part of that. For you and I, we've got an understanding of it because we were both involved in doing it and practicing those songs over and over so that we could lead a group of people to do them. But the philosophy aspect, I'd almost want to say the agenda, and the agenda has always been growth. So as the church it becomes increasingly polarized in Britain, I don't want to speak for the US, but in Britain, the church becomes increasingly polarized. Churches are shutting by the week. And to the extent where even in social media at the moment, there's this property, realtor, don't you? But a property guy over here is saying, hey, tell me if there's a church, and he's not a Christian, I don't think. If there's a church closing, tell me and I'll buy it. So we should want to keep it as a church, that it won't be turned into flats or apartments or a mosque, right? So there's this kind of political aspect to even the building. So this, the agenda of what's working and what's growing is this music first, a growth focus. And it's been like that since the 90s. And so you need to have in order to be one of these churches on the up and not on the down, when someone arrives, whether they've attended for years or it's their first day, the music needs to be on point.
I would agree. And one of the other things that I've been thinking through, so I get a lot of pushback specifically about Wimber, because Wimber did some good things. He was a good guy. I really have nothing against him. It's just the mess that was created, and he was involved in creating the mess. I'm more focused on the mess than I am him.
Yeah, sure.
But some of the mess, it so dramatically changed Christianity that I have to wonder how much of it he caused and how much of it the other guys caused. So usually the mess is attributed to Mike Bickle, Paul Kane, Kansas City Fellowship. Usually that's where you cast the blame. Mm-hmm. But when I think about the music structure, like I said, the focus of the worship, when I was playing, it was a worship to God. And even the songs that I was singing, none of the songs were about me. They weren't about, I was a songwriter as well. I would write some of the songs that I played. All of the songs that I wrote were about praise to God. None of it was about this intimate relationship with God. But what Wimber seemed to do was he tried to create a culture of intimate worship through music. So if you were to attribute one element, one building block of New Apostolic Reformation to Wimber, that's the building block that you would give him. And so then the question becomes, is that building block bad? When I started into my IT career, when I started my business, I talked to many different people who were also either CIOs of businesses that were well established, or they were developing a business that would be established. All of them told me this one central aspect: if you want to build a strong business, you first build a strong culture. If you can build a culture, you get people to adopt that culture. Everybody is more energetic, entertained. They want to work and build this culture. And that's the nature of humanity, right? Mm-hmm. Now, if you apply that to religion and consider the church growth strategy that you're talking about, which Wimber was clearly involved in, if you want to grow your church, what do you do first? You do it like a business. You have to run it like a business. If you don't run it like a business, you will never get the big building, because you have to have your expenses paid. You have to have a business strategy. Like, there's a whole business outline that these churches have to maintain to even keep the lights on. And nobody really, the average person doesn't realize this. That all starts first, though, with the culture, just like any business. You build a culture. So if you're building a culture about praise directly to God, it isn't about you, it's about God. Who's going to come into that culture and want a massive building? We don't need a massive building. We just need a direct connection to God, right? But if you instead make it such that the culture requires everything is about you, me, myself, and I, well, you're building a culture where everybody feels empowered. And so everybody wants to join in. They want to grow the church. And it is part of the church growth strategy. If you take that concept away, go back to the old liturgical hymns, you will never have a church growth like this.
No, the question, I guess, and what you've made me think is this church growth thing. So Soul Survivor, which I was part of, and I've been making videos on YouTube, and that's where we connected. Those, my experience of that was that Soul Survivor has had some positive impact among my generation and younger, in this country and around the world as well, to a lesser extent. But what came out was that the leader of it was a spiritually abusive, perhaps physically abusive, not necessarily sexually abusive, but certainly abusive enough to be called abusive, right? And so the work that was done has been queried because of that. You know, his motivations weren't entirely generous, and certainly not serving others first. They were serving his own needs. Now, what the Church of England is doing now, and I think this is a good example of what's happening in the US as well, is the Church of England realized that growth aim, using music and all the other things we've just spoken about, was successful 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago. And even though this has happened and hasn't been dealt with properly, they're going to put £3 million back into the name Soul Survivor and reawaken this as a missional opportunity among younger people. And it's this kind of blindness to individuals. So what I wonder is, when we're talking about this, my faith is still pretty strong. My faith in myself, probably less so, but my faith in Jesus is pretty strong. But my faith in the church couldn't be lower. And what I wonder is, well, for those of us where that culture hasn't worked and it's hurt us, it's broken us, it's abused us, where's the church for us? Now, the question I'm wondering and I'm asking is, and you asked it right at the beginning, is that large church just completely the wrong route? Is it that we need just to think church just needs to be small and it needs to be local and we need to look out for each other? That when the two or three are gathered, then he's with us. And how useful is this music? We've got to a stage now where, as I said, this chap, Martin Smith, is paid a lot of money to travel the US to train worship leaders or worship pastors in the US. These guys who are making music, so Matt Redman, who's another worship leader from the UK, he's making a lot of money based on what he's done and what he's doing. The industry surrounding this is worth an absolute fortune, you know, in Nashville, but over here as well, again on the South Coast. There are the two questions, the one of where you're talking about the agenda, but then also the personal relationship that it harbors and fosters and grows. Did the experience that I had in my teenage years and in my 20s and the culture that I perpetrated through music, has that built a maturity that's useful? And I don't know, because I still think about it fondly, in a kind of, oh yeah, I had an experience there that I can rest on now. But why is it that I find it so odd when I return to an environment that's replicating it? That's kind of where I'm up to at the moment. And there are so many like us. And so what's the church, and this kind of Wimber thing, And I remember you talking about this in a video previously. He renounced what he'd been doing. He said it wasn't a good move. Why did he end up in such a cul-de-sac, you know?
It's really a difficult question. Especially, so as a businessman, I have a lot of questions that your average person probably isn't going to have. Whenever I was learning how to grow my business, I started out as a software company, and over time it had to shift into executive level consulting. When it switched to consulting, I had to get some advice into how to grow that because it was out of my realm. One of the things that I learned was you get very ambitious, intelligent people to work with you who have a motive, who have a drive, and they will work harder for you than somebody who's just a watch the time clock kind of person. That's how business works, right?
Yeah.
When you get that type of person, however, their thoughts are more usually intended to grow themselves than the business. And that's what you want. You want personal growth within your organization. But there comes a point at which they outgrow the business and they'll either move on to something bigger or start their own business. And I actually had this happen a few times. It goes back to a good leader teaches people to lead themselves, not governing over them, right?
Yeah.
So when I think about it like that, when I'm talking to people who are in the Wimber fan club, they'll tell you immediately, they'll denounce the whole idea that he ever collaborated with a shepherding movement. He said, these people would say things like, John Wimber was anti-hierarchical structure. He did not like this, which is kind of true. But if you understand the agenda through the music and understand that if you're limiting the idea that people can grow beyond themselves, that they need this structure, they need this hierarchy. Even if you don't support the hierarchy, you're doing it through the music. You're doing the same exact thing, right?
Describe how that would be done.
So it goes back to the nature of the worship. So what's a good example? In Corinthians, I think it's 1 Corinthians maybe 6, it says something to the effect, you yourself, your body are the temple. You are the body of Christ, are the temple, right? So when you think of these big buildings, you don't need a church growth strategy. You, the people, are the temple of worship. Yeah. And what that's saying is basically they came out of a system where there were, whether they were pagan or whether they were Jewish, they came out of systems that had these massive temples, and you'd go to the temple, and that's the only place that you could receive the Holy Spirit. These passages of scripture, and that's just one example, they're saying things like, you have a direct connection to God. You don't even need the temple. Well, what has happened in the charismatic movement, and to some extent Pentecostalism before this, your leader, especially through the fivefold ministry construct, your leader was your mediator between God and man. If you didn't come to church, if you didn't go to the faith healing lines, you couldn't be healed. Yeah. Instead of preaching to people, go home and pray by yourself in your closet. You have the direct access to God. You can do what me, the healer on stage, is doing. None of them said this because there's no money in that. What they're trying to do is get the people to come to them, right?
Yeah.
Well, the structure of the music mimicked the style that was being preached in those tent revivals. It's all about you. It's all about the individual. It's not about your direct connection to God. It's about you need us, you need the worship leader to give you access to the Holy Spirit so you can become intimate with the Holy Spirit. And so it feels anti-hierarchical, right?
Yeah.
But you still have to have that concept of the worship leader on stage, or it doesn't work. None of it works. So yeah. It is, in effect, an authoritarian structure, but it's subtly disguised where people don't realize that it is.
Cool, that's incredibly insightful. Hey, John, I've really benefited from this call. Should we? Let's cut it. You're spot on, because you remember, I'm sure it made it across, but people were treating church services or meetings as they'd call it like a petrol, like a fuel stop, right? Hey, I get filled up on the Sunday. And so your job when you were leading worship or when you were attending these big things like Soul Survivor, we saw it as being the opportunity where we would be filled up. And each day, each week, each month, would slowly the fuel would be dwindling down and we can't get to empty. Where do we go? We're on empty. And you're absolutely right. So these experiences and the aim, yeah, that you govern the people with an experience.
As you were talking, we weren't allowed the new modern style worship, but there was this old bluegrassy gospel song that I used. I listened to it. I can't tell you how many times. Bring them into the filling station. Back in the old days in America, you called the gas station the filling station. Yep. And the whole song was about coming to church to be filled up. Bring us into the filling station. And as the whole model, now that I look at it, that whole model is just so wrong. Yes, I'm not saying that you don't go to church. So whoever's listening, don't think that I'm anti-church. But I'm anti the fact that you must do it in order to achieve that same connection to God. I think an individual sitting down in their own bedroom with their Bible can have the same access to God as going to one of these churches. But the new modern style churches won't tell you this. They don't want you to, because why would you? Why would you come to church and give us all this money for this big building, these fancy lights, paying the worship leader? I've seen this too, and it just blows your mind, man. Why? Why would you do? I would rather, even if I had a big church, say I was a mega pastor, and I don't even want to be a pastor, but say that I was. Yeah. I would want a worship style where, okay, you kids on the front row, can any of you play a ukulele? Come up here with me. Any of you people who play the organ, play the piano, come on, let's take turns. Let's worship God together. I mean, that's the kind of style that I think Jesus was advocating for. But it's turned around such that it has become a concert. Even in the small churches, I have seen, we actually made fun of them in some of the Branham churches. We'd see this family get up, and the family was just so full of it, thought that they were some gospel group, you know, and singing one of the gospel group songs that's popular. And sounded, you know, not that great, but they were so filled with themselves. It was more, we were laughing because it was more about them than the worship to God. If it had have been the other scenario, come on up and sing. Can you sing? Well, even if you can't sing well, that's okay. Praise to God. If it was more about the praise to God, that would make sense to me. But since it's about the individual, about the intimate relationship, about the concert, none, from a musician standpoint, none of this makes any sense.
But there is, so then the flip side to that is at Christmas, on Christmas Day, again, my wife sings in this abbey in the choir, and I think I had a cold or something. So I went online to watch a Zoom service. My mate runs a church in a local town, and I thought I'd look at what he was up to with his congregation. And the women that were leading the singing were, I mean, they were off. they were off. And I was watching it, sitting at my kitchen table with my coffee and, you know, my mince pie. And I was like, wow, this is really distracting me from the idea of worship right now. So there is the flip side to it, isn't there? There is this, you know, there is this need for excellence. We do read about David playing excellently, and the spirits leave or give Saul a bit of a break, right? There is this sense of excellence required. Otherwise, what's the point of practicing and becoming the best at anything? We could just be absolutely mediocre as our work in our worship to God. So I would counter that a little bit.
I will counter your counter.
Okay, go on.
In the style of worship that has been created, when I say it's been upended, I mean it has truly been upended. In the style of worship that has been created, what you said makes sense. If the focus is on one group of ladies singing, absolutely. If they sound off key, nobody wants to come back. It's awful. If you're a musician, you're like, oh, I can't take this. Think back to the old congregations before Wimber, before the Latter Rain, before the Healing Revival, before the pre-versions of the Healing Revival. Before the PA, everybody's coming to church and everyone is singing in the building. And if one person is off key, the others help them. They help them get back into their key because they can listen and kind of, even if you can't carry a tune in a box, you'll be outdroned by the rest of the people in the congregation, right? Take my example of, hey, can you kids come play? You're not expecting them to be modern professionals. And if they come up and sing and they're off key, we'll get a bunch of kids and get a bunch of kids off key and everybody's happy, right? Because the kids are doing it. Yeah. There are ways that you can do it where it is It's not about the people, it's about the worship. And I think the problem is the model that has been created, it creates scenarios exactly like you're describing. That scenario would not exist without the model that has been created here.
So it's just wrong.
In my opinion, it's wrong. But that's my opinion. Who knows? Everybody else may have a different opinion.
I think the one to counter your counter of my counter would be when you hear choral singing in an old building.
Mm.
So when, again, the stuff that my wife perhaps does, you know, she sings in a choir that they sing, they'll be, I think, in the Vatican in a year or two, singing in one of whichever, whatever the name of the Catholic Church there is, it's St. Mark's maybe. She'll be there singing very simply, but very with real expertise.
You just pounded my point to the T. So, as a musician, and you, I think you'll get this as a musician, when you're playing with the intent to help people sing, anything that you do really fancy, really complex runs on the guitar, you're going to do it in between the voices. You're going to do the part where the people are singing very simplistically so that they can get it simplistically.
Yeah.
In the old style churches, before any of this existed, you did have a choir that had really one rule. You can't sing off key because our purpose as a choir is to, unless you're singing as a choir alone, the purpose of the choir is to help the congregation stay on key. So it becomes like if you're playing the piano and you play the simple chords while people are singing, the choir becomes an instrument instead of a instead of entertainment, right? Now, there are cases I know where the choir says, we want to hear just the choir singing. It's kind of a complex gray area for me, but at its essence, the problem is it has become more about the entertainment. I went to a church recently. This is another good example that you helped emphasize. I went to a church recently where the people on stage were the show, and they said, okay, everybody turn to this page. And so I got out my book and I'm start singing. And they're doing all of these riffs and runs and scales with their voices in between the notes. I actually had trouble singing with them. And it was a song that I wasn't that familiar with. I could see the notes and I could see where I'm supposed to go down, 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 up, down, down, right? And they're going down, 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 up, 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 down. The two clashed because they had been created in a world where it was all about the people on the stage. It wasn't about the individual. But yet they're singing songs where you have to feel the emotional spirit, and it has to be this intimate relationship for you. It actually didn't work for me because I didn't feel intimate. I felt like these people need to be quiet so I can sing.
And you've made me think. So last week I went to I meet with a friend who's a monk. He's 81. There's a monastery just down the road, 7 miles. So it's just quite bizarre. And they have me for lunch sometimes. We don't speak while we're eating. We just read. There's three elderly men, and that's it in the monastery. And two of the monks were preoccupied. So it was just Brother Christopher, who's actually from New York, and I. And we went through one of the offices, and we just had a book. There was no instrument. I think he blew the note on a mouth organ. And we got the note, and then we just simply sang these few verses. Some were just lifted straight from the Psalms. And then we prayed, and you sort of followed the kind of melody as I was reading it along in this book. And there was such a simplicity to our worship. Obviously, there was just two of us, me and an 81-year-old guy whose ear for notes isn't perfect, and my eyes for reading music isn't perfect either. But we ended up with this thing where it was just this model or this example of we're worshiping together, and we're doing and I the luxury that he does it four times in the chapel every day or something, you know, at 5 o'clock in the morning and everything else. And I just step in once a while, not 5 o'clock in the morning, in the middle of the day, and I join him in this practice, or join the other monks in this practice. And hey, I it's about my friendship with them that we're worshiping together. the experience is pretty like, well, that was weird. But it was about, it's about our friendship. You're challenging me, because I mean, people ask me, you know, all the time, and you must get this too, like, especially when you're speaking on Christian matters. So do you go to church? And if you don't, then we don't have to listen to you. You clearly don't have any authority here. You know, this weird kind of, you know, Lord of the Rings-esque theology. But I'm going to, I'm involved in church. I go to a monastery. I don't think like that. But even in when you were talking about the agenda, when we're talking in this stuff, people need to know where you stand. They need to know how you worship. There's just with your habit. How do you represent a Christianity that has become so mainline that it's become authoritative? And the new apostolic stuff, the are you an apostle, are you a prophet, are you a teacher, are you an evangelist? All of these things, we need to put ourselves in a certain box in order to be listened to by everyone else in the box. And yet, as you said, well, we are the temple. Oh, it's so upside down, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's so much to think through. You've made me think too. Like, I'm.
Why are we so lost? Why are we so lost right now? When I watch your videos, when I watch a few other people on YouTube and have lots of conversations, so many of us are saying, "Is this? Are we doing this right?"
There's a lot to think through, and for me, I'm not saying that I even have the answers or even that my opinion is correct, but I am forming an opinion, and it's based off of. Oddly enough, it's based off of my experiences. Is the experience type religion wrong? I don't know. I can't say that it is. Does it lead to the authoritarian structures? Historically, it has proven itself to do this. So for me, it's not even about my opinion so much as we're seeing what's happened. We're seeing the results of this style of worship. Now we have to think, is it something about the worship that's causing it? Or is there something else wrong? And that's why I'm digging. And that's why I wanted to have you on, because I wanted your opinion. So thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure having a conversation with you. Thank you again.
Awesome. Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.